Welcome to Behavioral Health Today, a podcast by Triad Behavioral Health, covering trending topics in behavioral and mental health. This podcast is designed to share unique and relevant topics occurring within the world and our communities and bring them a mental health perspective.
Welcome to Behavior Health Today. I'm your host, Dr. Graham Taylor, and today I am joined by Lauren Smoller. Lauren is the Senior Director of Programs at the National Eating Disorders Association, also referred to as NEDA. She's been with the organization since 2011. Prior to serving in her current capacity, Lauren directed NEDA's helpline services, where she facilitated the expansion of the treatment provider database and the addition of live chat and Facebook support options for the helpline. Lauren continues to grow NEDA's programs and services to provide information, prevention strategies, and ongoing support to individuals and families at risk for or currently affected by eating disorders through NEDA's helpline services, conferences, support programming, and awareness initiatives and partnerships. Lauren, it's so great to have you with us here today. Welcome to Behavioral Health Today.
Thanks for having me.
Lauren, I'm really excited to have you with us on the show today because we're talking about eating disorders in recognition of the National Eating Disorders Awareness Week, February 22nd through February 28th. Lauren, as we come into this topic today of eating disorders, set for us kind of a cornerstone understanding of what patterns of eating might we see that allow us to diagnose certain types of eating behavior that actually we can define as a disorder?
Sure. What's going to make an eating disorder is really a pattern of disordered eating or thoughts and behavior surrounding food. So what you're going to look for when you're talking about eating disorders, the concerning signs can look different from person to person. But what is going to be the same is that those thoughts and behaviors are not healthy. They're potentially life-threatening and health compromising, and they are going to be able to really significantly affect somebody's life. So that means it's going to get in the way of their ability to go to school, to be able to do their work, to be able to pay attention. Long-term, that's really going to be some of the effects that a disorder may have. It's really a life-threatening mental illness. And so when you're looking out for different things that could be signs of concern, you're looking for those types of patterns and changes in what somebody's healthy, consistent behaviors might have been before. So that can be going on a diet and making a very significant life change. We often see sort of the key disordered eating behaviors being restrictive eating or purging any kind of food that they may have ingested or overconsuming food, so binge eating in large quantities of food in a shortened amount of time.
That's really helpful. I'd like to get into more of the types of eating disorders a little bit later on in the show. And also, you're talking about something that's very, very important for us to understand. This can be a life-threatening disorder. But as you're starting us out, what I'm understanding is this is a serious condition with this persistent eating behaviors that negatively have an impact on one's health, like you're saying, on their emotions, and equally important, on their ability to function normally in life. And it can also include that preoccupation, whether it's with food or their body weight. These are some of the signals, aren't they, that someone is experiencing something disordered in their eating behaviors?
Yeah, and just like you said, eating disorders have the second highest mortality rate of any mental illness. They're surpassed only by opioid addiction. So they're significantly dangerous and really is something serious to consider.
Yeah, that's helpful. Let's flag that one more time, and we're going to come back because I want people to appreciate this, not just something that someone's going through or some myths and perceptions and beliefs that we have that I'm going to talk about also as well. But let's anchor this a little bit further with the various forms of eating behaviors we're going to get to. But before we do, what do we know about some of the origin or the cause of someone developing or experiencing an eating disorder? What's going into this disordered eating?
So there are many things that can contribute to an eating disorder. There's not going to be one cause. It really will be a little bit different from person to person.
Yes.
But we know that eating disorders are affected by a number of different factors. There are social implications. There is a genetic component to eating disorders. There are personality behaviors that can increase somebody's risk of getting an eating disorder. And a lot of this can really be a combination.
I think what makes this such a complex disorder to both experience and to treat is like you're saying, there's a myriad of things here that go into it. It's the genetic and the biological piece, the genes that increase the risk, and even some brain chemicals that we know play a role in eating disorders. And what you're also bringing in is that we know brain images show that there are patterns of brain activity, let's say in women with eating disorders in comparison with healthy women that are different. And the other part you're saying too, is that there's a genetic piece where we know that eating disorders can run in families too, can't they?
Yeah, that's right. We know that there often are patterns of behavior that happen across families.
I think an underlying cause that I appreciate you naming earlier too was the psychological and the emotional health components that come into this. They have psychological and emotional challenges that contribute and can perpetuate this disorder. Things like low self-esteem and perfectionism, we know, impulsive behavior and in troubled relationships. And like you mentioned, depression and anxiety are also pretty commonly experienced in these eating disorders too, aren't they?
That's right. A lot of mental health stressors co-occur with eating disorders and can increase someone's risk of getting an eating disorder if they're already dealing with something like anxiety or depression or a low system of social support. All of those can increase someone's risk of getting an eating disorder.
I really appreciate you bringing in the various components because it's not just a simple one situational thing. It's a myriad of things that come together and oftentimes very entangled, very enmeshed ways that make it a very challenging. Now, there is hope here. I don't want to be bleak in what I'm saying, but there's a tremendous amount of hope, but also to appreciate that as we're talking about this, folks don't just say, well, you know, maybe it's not all that bad a thing. In fact, I want to segue into something as we're talking about the various things that go into this disorder. As we're talking about some of the underlying causes, what about those perceptions and beliefs that folks sometimes say? They might say, hey, well, all they got to do is take control of their eating. You know, all they need to do is simply, in let's say the case of overeating, all they need to do is stop eating. Or this idea of maybe they just lack discipline, or someone with an eating disorder is just seeking attention, or maybe it's just a lifestyle choice. Debunk these very dangerous perceptions and beliefs for us, would you?
That's a great point. There are a lot of myths, misconceptions about eating disorders. Yeah. One, like you mentioned, is there's a belief that eating disorders are a choice. And we really have to remember, this is a mental health issue. This is a mental illness. No one's choosing to do this. These people that are struggling are really not doing this because they feel like this is a good choice. This is a whole different level. They're feeling this compelling need to behave this way. And that's one of the reasons that we really stress why professional specialized support from an eating disorder professional is so important to get help when you're struggling with an eating disorder. I think another piece of that is recognizing that there are a lot of stereotypes that people do have about eating disorders that also are not the whole truth, right? I think there's this perception that eating disorders really only occur in young white women, particularly affluent women, and that's simply not the case. Eating disorders really do not discriminate. They can occur to any gender at various different ages. We're seeing them earlier in life as well as later in life. Mm-hmm. They can happen at any socioeconomic status. Mm-hmm. There are people who are low income that are severely struggling with eating disorders and may just not have access to care. And people from all different races and ethnicities as well will struggle.
That's really good. Really good. I want to anchor something you said. There's a number of things here that are pretty pithy here that I like, but I want to come back and anchor something here. This is not a choice. This is not something that they're willfully doing. In fact, when you anchor it in the idea that this is a mental illness, this is a struggle, they do not have control.
You'll find that people feel like they are doing this as a way of control. And simply that's sort of the nature of the disorder in itself, right? Is this feeling of needing control, and they don't have it right now.
That's really good. So it is used for aspects of control, but they're not in control of that type of control as they're trying to manage things in their life. That's a really good way to kind of link those two things together. And this idea that eating disorders don't differentiate on gender, age, affluence, socioeconomic levels, whatever it may be, ethnic, race, whatever. It doesn't differentiate at all around that. And that's why some of the stereotypes and beliefs can be so challenging. What you said earlier too is, these eating disorders are starting earlier and earlier. How early are we seeing some of these eating disorders kind of show up in people?
It really is going to depend on the particular diagnosis. We are seeing kids as young as 8 that have diagnoses of some of the disorders. Yeah. We're also seeing people who are much older. You know, I think that there's a perception that you kind of age out of this, and that's just simply not true. there are people who may have experienced an eating disorder earlier in their life and then experience it again later. There are also people who never experienced it before and then later in life do get an eating disorder.
Yeah. As we're talking about the various ages, it can start as early as 8, maybe before, kind of go all the way out. You don't age out of it. You can get it at any age. Given that, what might be some of the red flags that we might be able to see, maybe on the outside looking in, or maybe even someone kind of as they're listening, even in the show today, begin to recognize in themselves red flags that indicate that they may be beginning to struggle or are struggling with some eating behaviors that are going to be problematic?
Yeah, we talked a little bit about this in the beginning, but it's really going to differ from person to person. The piece that's going to show that there's a sign of concern is this dramatic change. Sometimes, you know, I'll even say that it's not obviously dramatic, but there are changes in attitudes and behaviors around food. When you're observing someone, you may not always be able to tell if they're actively struggling. You may see in other mental health issues as well, similar behaviors where people become more reserved. In particular with eating disorders, a lot of times you may see that people are no longer comfortable around food or in social situations with food. There may be changes in weight in either direction that can be an indication, and there may not be. Sometimes it's not going to be something that is that obvious. Those are those most subtle things. And if you're observing behaviors that have changed dramatically in somebody, even if it's their attitude around food, or their feelings around being around food, those can be signs of concern and something to really look into and get help for.
That's really good. I know when we're talking about the eating disorders, and I'm going to ask you a little bit later on, one of the reasons I'm kind of teeing these red flags up for us is if we're noticing these, I'm going to ask you later in our talk today to help me craft some language. If I'm somebody that I am seeing these behaviors emerge in someone I know or care about, and how I might kind of approach that, because I know it can be a sensitive thing, but you're bringing up again some of the red flags that are really good. Maybe there's, you know, excessive focus on overly healthy eating, or maybe withdrawing from social activities. We might even find them, some of their narrative being about complaining about being fat or having to lose weight. Or you talked about earlier about perceptions and how they might, you know, be looking in the mirror, looking for perceived flaws. We might even see some behaviors, maybe even at the dinner table, you know, where they're getting up to use the restroom frequently during a meal. They might be going in there to purge, or they might be, you know, eating in secret. These are some additional signs, aren't they, too, that begin to allow us to see, hey, wait a minute, there's something here that's a little bit off course of what normal eating might look like.
That's right. They're all of these little subtle almost changes that can culminate into what is really an eating disorder.
Yeah. That's good. Hey, would you just kind of review briefly the various types of eating disorders and give us an understanding what occurs within each of those various eating disorders that we're kind of referring to here?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the most common one that people know about is anorexia, and that is typically going to be somebody who has restrictive behaviors. There is a stereotype that people who are struggling with that may look a certain way, and it's really important to recognize that's simply not true. There can be people really with any eating disorder that will struggle at any size. But anorexia is typically categorized by extreme restriction of food. Then we also have bulimia. Bulimia can be most commonly categorized by binge eating, so consuming a large amount of food in a shorter amount of time, combined with purging. And what purging can look like for bulimia is a number of different types of behaviors. Some of the most common ones would be vomiting, laxative abuse, or overexercise. There can be some other behaviors. Ultimately, it's this feeling of wanting to get rid of the food as a result of a binge. And then another eating disorder, which is also quite common, but is not as much talked about, is binge eating disorder. And binge eating disorder is, again, binge eating, several episodes of binge eating, but not with the purging component usually. There is just episodes of binging, and then there may be some cyclical behavior as well, but it's really categorized by having a large amount of food in a short amount of time.
Got it.
And again, I think there's also a perception with binge eating disorder in particular that people tend to be higher weight who are struggling. And it's important to recognize that's also not true. There are people who are all sizes that are actively struggling with binge eating disorder and really in need of help.
Very good.
And there are also some lesser known eating disorders. One is pica, and that's really ingesting non-food substances. So this is something that's really not talked about, and it's very serious and really does need medical attention. And there, rumination is another one. We sort of call chewing and spitting is sometimes what it's referred to, which is how it sounds. Another one that really does need attention and is just not talked about enough. There's also avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. And this is one that is something that you may see earlier as well. It's sort of what I explained to in sort of lay terms is that it's picky eating, but from a clinical level, right? So it's really serious. The picky eating is so restrictive that there's malnourishment as a result often, and it's really affecting someone's life. So it's not just a couple of foods that they're uncomfortable with. It's really not being able to try those foods. And like I said, this is a mental illness. So it's really beyond just choosing not to like food. This is not something that they're choosing to do, and it's getting in the way of them being able to lead their life.
Yeah, that's really helpful. You know, as you're going over each one of those and you're talking about the experiences within each one, we can begin to see that over a long period of time, these eating disorders, going back to what you said earlier in our talk today, these eating disorders can really pose a risk of significant harm to someone's life, can't they? What are some of the things you know about the harm that can be induced here by these eating practices?
Yeah, that's right. They are life-threatening. People die from eating disorders, unfortunately. And that's one of the reasons that it's so important that if you see some signs of concern, that you get help as early as you can.
Yeah.
When you're seeing, you know, I think very commonly you will see that restriction is huge. If you're not getting the nutrients you need, there's a host of different consequences for your body. Right. Ultimately, not being able to function anymore. If you're not receiving the nutrients that you need for your body to operate, your organs can stop working in kind of the most severe sense of that. There are other consequences as things progress, and then, frankly, they will affect people differently. So that another thing that I would love to emphasize is that if you're not experiencing those medical symptoms, it does not mean that you don't have an eating disorder. And
very
it also
good.
Doesn't mean that your eating disorder is not significant and very important and in need of critical care. We unfortunately hear stories all the time of people who think that they're perfectly okay, and then finally receive medical treatment and find out that they are in a much more severe state than they thought. So it's important that if you are observing this, any signs of an eating disorder, that you get help as soon as you can.
That's an important emphasis. Just because I'm not seeing something, even some of the things we're talking about today, or it doesn't mean that there's not this accumulative effect that's happening. And it can kind of reach a culminative place, can it, in a way that can be very, very dangerous and very life-threatening, sometimes not even reversible. But there's some really great things that we can talk about. And we're going to talk about some treatment options in just a moment. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
Behavioral and mental health professionals provide critical support to our communities in a time when our communities need it more than ever. But they need support too, to continue their education, to connect with colleagues, and to advance their career. And so we've launched Triad, the hub for behavioral and mental health professionals. At Triad, you'll find education, community, and career resources for both current and aspiring behavioral and mental health professionals, all curated specifically for you and all for free. Visit us at hellotriad.com/BHT to register for your free professional account. Again, that's hellotriad.com/BHT. Come join the community today.
I want to bring in two other pieces, though, here that I think are really relevant in this time of our lives. One, what is the impact, starting with first, social media and comparative tendencies that we tend to get ourselves involved with, particularly young people, social media, and the effect of COVID that we're in right now, and its impact, both of those, on eating disorders. What are you finding?
So social media is amazing, right? It's a huge tool for community, in particular when we're talking about COVID. Sometimes it's the only sense of community that people have as a safe option right now. So it is important to recognize that for the population in general, but in particular for people with eating disorders, it can provide an amazing community. However, the larger kind of mainstream social media culture is also heavily influenced by something that we call diet culture. And yes, that can be quite harmful for the population in general, but in particular for people who might be at risk of an eating disorder or already actively struggling. There's a huge emphasis in our culture in general that's very pervasive on social media about looking a certain size or a perception of what health is and expected to look like in terms of behaviors. And all of those things can really bring a lot of pressure to people, in particular on social media, where they're really only seeing kind of the best representation of a person and not the whole picture behind their life.
Yeah, I agree with that piece. There are inherently a lot of challenges with our social media. At the same time, you're also saying there's some really great things. We're on a social media platform right now that allows us to get this message out. This is at its best right here. But there's also some real risks given the things that are available to our kids. And I have a message going out to parents too, you know, on how they get to monitor their children's use of all ages, even into their teenage years, being able to help them see that there are some things out there that can be damaging and harmful, and for the parents to be involved in what is seen and what is viewed, and also to help sometimes right size, you know, the things you're saying right now. These are some of the best pictures people could ever take of themselves. They're holding their breath for 60 seconds to get that perfect picture, but it's not the real deal. It's not the whole story. So talk about COVID and our time in isolation, having a quarantine, and its impact on maybe eating disorders. What are you noticing there?
Yeah, so COVID's had a significant impact on eating disorders. Our helpline has seen a 40% increase in calls.
Oh my.
So we've really seen a direct impact of people who really need to reach out for additional support or support for the first time as a result of COVID. And we've also seen patterns of the way that people are communicating change. So we've seen an 85% increase on our chat function, because that's really where people felt safe talking when they're in close quarters with people and they're not ready to disclose what they're going through.
Yeah.
And I think that actually does go back to social media in a way, right? So we found an amazing sense of community. Sometimes people who had in-person care or in-person support that is no longer available right now because it's not safe to be able to conduct treatment that way, or it wasn't earlier in the pandemic before we knew more, were able to find access to care virtually. And some of that took place in support environments over social media. Sometimes it took place through, you know, video conferencing kind of tools. So there's been an amazing opportunity.
So good.
And one of the great things about that is there are people who previously did not have access to care because of location or time or childcare, what have you, that now with this new virtual world, we're able to find help and support that they may have needed before and may need even more so now, that was not really available as an option to them for a variety of different reasons.
That's so good. That's so good. It's so great you guys are available too, to help steer people in right directions and to get the help they need and the connections that really benefit them during this time. What do we know about some of the treatment approaches? We have a disorder here that has a really good prognosis. If we can identify some of these things and begin to kind of get into a treatment around it, what are some treatments that you're seeing being most efficacious for those going through this disorder?
So the most important thing is to recognize that eating disorders are so complex and they really are different from person to person. So different levels of care are going to be important for different people in terms of severity, and sort of how the eating disorder is going to affect them will determine whether or not they want residential care or inpatient treatment, which might be 24-hour support, or outpatient care that is going to be much less frequent, could be once a week or several times a week, depending on the needs. Eating disorders also, as I said, are complex. So they have generally a multidisciplinary team. So it's not simply seeing a therapist. Right. There's often a combination of treatment teams that are working together to be successful for this person, navigating the medical component. There's often a dietitian involved as well as a therapist. And depending on that individual and the other needs, there may be some other pieces of that team that's involved too. And one of the things that is important to recognize is because they're so complex, when possible, it's really critical to find professionals that specialize in eating disorders, because they need to be able to sort of understand just how complex this disorder is and how individualized it is.
I think that's a really good emphasis right there. This has to be somebody who specializes in this disorder, who has the training and experience to be able to address the multi-layered components of this. You're saying that it is a complex disorder, and what we're talking about right now and what you're giving us some sense of are ways that people can enter into and benefit from some treatment around this. And there's a good hopeful prognosis around this. But we also know, like you're saying, there's some real strong emotional components around it too, including guilt or shame, or the idea that they're going to have to let go of something that's given them some sense of control in their life. So if I'm seeing somebody and I see someone in my life that I care about or someone that I know, and I'm seeing some of these risk factors that I'm learning from you today that could be some early indicators in someone's life, I want to be able to address that person and bring this to their attention, or at least to a conversation level between us. But I know it's, again, kind of complex and sensitive. And can you craft some language for me on how I might bring this up with them and in a way that would be helpful and non-judgmental or shaming? How would I say it?
Yeah, well, that is tough. And it really does depend on your relationship with the individual. Like you mentioned, eating disorders do have a lot of shame associated with them by nature. And it's not the individual's fault that they're struggling, but there is a lot of isolation that's part of the disorder, where there's a lot of resistance to wanting to talk about the eating disorder and disclosing that they may need help. Part of the disorder also is often that they aren't aware of the severity of their particular situation. So that's really challenging when you're talking to an individual that you care about and trying to get them help.
Can I say something about that just real quick? I think that's a really key point. They may not know what they don't know about what they're in. This idea that the mental illness part of it may not include them understanding that they're really struggling. They don't see it that way, do they? So part of what you're saying here is, one, they may not know it, and then we get to maybe bring it to their attention, but there's a way to do it that can be helpful. Continue, please. That's a good point.
One of the reasons that it's so important to be really careful and non-judgmental when you're approaching that person is because there is this perception, right? We talked a little bit earlier about this stereotype.
Yeah.
Many people who are actively struggling with an eating disorder are very afraid that they don't struggle enough to deserve care. And it's one of the reasons that it's so important to recognize that the earlier you get help, the better. Everyone deserves to have care, and as early as possible, to be able to get as much support as they can, hopefully before the behaviors get so severe. And if they are getting more severe, then anyone at any point deserves care. So having a conversation with a loved one or somebody that you care about from a very non-judgmental perspective and letting them know that you've observed certain things that you may be concerned about and offering an opportunity to get help is important, but also recognizing that sometimes that conversation may just be just like that. And that is often just a very first step for somebody. Another great way to be able to support them is to direct them to a place where they can get specialized support and start that conversation in a safe space. Mm-hmm. So sometimes just letting them know, for example, about the National Eating Disorders Association helpline or our screening tool can be a great first step for somebody who might not be ready to talk about it with others yet. They may need some time to process that. And having that initial conversation and letting them know that there are options available for them to be able to start that conversation can be a great first step.
That's really great. You're kind of segueing us in the next area that I wanted to go in. I want to talk about, I know we're unfortunately kind of winding down on our time today, but I would love to take a moment and have you share with us some of the resources that you're describing here, including a screening tool that you just mentioned that might be a nice way to both introduce somebody into learning more about what they may be in, as well as a community of people that can really be helpful. Give us some resources that you might recommend our listeners to take a look at, please.
Yeah. So one of the things that I did mention is our screening tool. That's a great first step for somebody who's just not sure where they're at. We talked a little bit about how it's really hard to gauge just how serious an eating disorder might be, in particular if you're struggling yourself. And that's nothing to be ashamed of. It's very hard to be able to gauge the level of severity. And we really recommend that if at any point you have any concerns, even if before it reaches the point of a significant eating disorder, that you get help. But if you're not sure, the screening tool at nationaleatingdisorders.org/screening is a great first step. It's just a few minutes. You answer a number of questions about your thoughts and behaviors, and it will tell you whether or not you're at risk. And it also gives you some opportunities for support options if you are at risk for kind of your next step when you're ready. Another resource is our helpline. And that's a place where you can talk to a trained volunteer and figure out what your options are. Where are you with the disorder, or where is your loved one if you're looking for support for them? What treatment options might be available based on what you're going through? And that trained volunteer can walk you through that process and provide a listening ear so that they can be there for you. We have callers who often were the first people that they're talking to about this because we're a safe, confidential place where they can disclose what they're going through, and we can give them next steps and information and tools to be able to move forward.
Man, those are great. Those are great. I love having someone to talk to that can be safe and just kind of walk us through some ideas, and we can be introduced to something just to consider and ponder and maybe come to some decisions around and have information that maybe we didn't even know, one that exists, or maybe that we're even exhibiting some signs of. So that's wonderful. Lauren, in addition to those resources that you gave us, I also know that the National Eating Disorders Awareness Week, as I mentioned at the beginning of our time today, is occurring from February 22nd to February 28th. Give us kind of a picture of what's going to be happening during that time and what folks can expect and maybe join in and be involved in.
Sure. So National Eating Disorders Awareness Week takes place February 22nd to the 28th. So it's the last week of February. And this year we're celebrating a theme of everybody has a seat at the table. And that's really centering stories from individuals that typically are not thought of or not heard of who are struggling with eating disorders and having an opportunity for those conversations to take place. So we're having a number of panels discussing different experiences in communities that are affected by eating disorders, including the Black community, the LGBTQ plus community, the higher weight community, as well as caregivers. And we're offering them an opportunity to really discuss the different issues and concerns and opportunities that they have experienced within their own communities related to eating disorders. It's an opportunity to really learn about the way that that eating disorders affect those different communities and bust those stereotypes and really find out that eating disorders really don't just occur to that stereotype that we discussed earlier.
Yes. Yeah, that's really helpful. Thanks for giving us kind of a foreview of what's going to be happening in that time. And those listening, that'd be a great thing to participate in. Thanks for the heads up on that. Lauren, I want to thank you for joining us today. What a great time it's been being with you and for what you're doing, what you're bringing to our awareness, making some of these things more conscious and aware to us, both for those that might be involved in it or for those listening that might have a loved one or someone close to them that they might see going through something like this, allowing us to have a way to both understand this as well as ways to approach them in it that can be safe and very supportive. So thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Been great to have you here. And to those listening in, as always, we appreciate you being with us, and we'll look forward to having you join us in our next time together on Behavioral Health Today.
We appreciate all the support from our community, and if you like our show, one of the best ways you can support it is by giving us a 5-star rating and leaving a review. Behavioral Health Today is a podcast part of the Tried Behavioral Health Network, all rights reserved.